Greetings, friends. Welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the film review podcast, where good taste and bad taste collide into one another 100 times over.
It's our 100th episode! Na 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 na. We have nothing planned.
We do have something planned. Mm. We're going to review films.
We have nothing different planned. we celebrate the way we do everything else. Mm. We watch movies. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. I don't have a cute nickname. I don't need one.
And we've had quite a few 100th episodes in our career. Yeah. We've done a variety of podcasts, and most of them tend to last a long-ass time.
The 100th anniversary is the Diamond Anniversary, I believe. I'd have to look that up to be sure. I'm pretty sure it's the Diamond Anniversary.
Okay.
I know...
not many people get there.
If you if your marriage lasts 100 years.
Yeah. Only then do you get a diamond.
I'm guessing you married when you were still teenagers.
I would imagine.
And you made it to it, so you're like 116, 118.
Unless cryogenic freezing is involved.
Maybe you live on a different planet and years are a different length.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, yeah, if you're going to give a gift, you have to give like a $10,000 diamond
or
something.
And if you give a diamond to your spouse, a significant other, before you've been together for 100 years, bad luck. It's just bad luck. I wouldn't do it. It's not a good idea. Anyway, this week on Critically Acclaimed, where we review movies, we're reviewing the new releases The Power of the Dog, Benedetta, Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Flea, Wolf, and Torn. Now,
And The Hand of God.
Oh, I forgot The Hand of God. That's right. Whoops.
New Paolo Sorrentino joint.
Paolo Sorrentino joint.
we'll talk about Paolo. Do you want to start with Paolo Sorrentino?
No, I don't want to start with... Right. No.
All right.
No, I want to start with something I want to talk about. But where was it going with this? This episode's like a day or two late. I had like a long weekend with the movie Trivia Schmodown, and I kind of just threw everything out of whack. We're going to get back on that horse and just ride it into a more proper podcasting schedule. The allegory falls flat real fast, but
the point is you were busy.
I was busy, and I apologize.
Competing in a high profile movie trivia tourney.
High stakes too. If I lost, they would have cut off my thumbs.
People were, that's the way it works over at the Schmodown.
Yeah,
I'm not going to ask you how you did because I think it might be under wraps.
If anyone is listening and hasn't heard yet, I'm not going to ruin it for you. But generally speaking, they treat it like a pay per view sporting event. Okay. If you wanted to see it, you would have paid for it, that kind of thing. So we'll announce the winners. It's out there. But if you are trying to like stay pure and like watch it, but you can't afford to play along, I'm not going to spoil it here. If you follow along on Twitter, you might already have it spoiled. But
that was,
why not? But regardless, it was a really good show.
It was an enormous event.
Yeah, it was
and
a live
it
show.
Took
it was
away
awesome.
From some of our podcasting time, but we're back on track now. We're a day late.
Yeah. But not a dollar short. In fact, many dollars short because the economy is bad. But
and this is the end of the year, and this is super duper crunch time. So we're getting so many high profile releases.
We're getting slammed
awards
like
contenders.
Every week's going to be full of awards contenders, and that's on top of the would be blockbusters. Like we got a new Spider-Man coming out, new Matrix coming out,
Spider-Man 8 and Matrix 4 and all the rest.
Hey, maybe they'll be fun. But right now, this week, first week of December. Usually not a big week for the blockbusters, but there's a lot of really interesting indie art house international films that are out right now, and that's very exciting.
If you're like us, a weekend where there's not just a Paolo Sorrentino movie, but a new Jane Campion and a new Paul Verhoeven movie, that's definitely noteworthy.
That's a cool weekend.
Yeah.
So let's get started, and let's start with, I like dogs.
You like dogs?
You like dogs?
I'm more of a cat person. I don't hate dogs. I just don't want to live with one.
So you wouldn't say that you respect the power of the dog.
Oh my God.
You didn't think I was going there?
I knew you were going there. There is no dog in The Power of the Dog.
There is actually a dog.
It's not vital to the plot.
No, it is not. But there is technically a dog.
Fine. Jane Campion made a movie called The Power of the Dog. It's based on a novel from 1967, and it is a Western.
Yeah.
It takes place in the 1920s on a ranch. And it is about toxic masculinity.
Oh boy, howdy is it. Benedict Cumberbatch and Jesse Plemons play wealthy brothers Jesse Plemons fancies himself a bit more of a urbanite,
yeah.
Urbanite sophisticate. And Benedict Cumberbatch, even though he has like a lot of like, you know, fancy book learning, he fancies himself a man of the land and likes to cover himself with mud and like wrestle cows and like be a total badass.
There's a lot of shots of nude men in this film.
A lot.
And I'm not saying that because, you know, for lascivious reasons. I think Jane Campion is looking at the way men sort of wield their nude bodies in nature as a way to commune with it and maybe dominate it.
Well, this is a story about men who live alone. The men at this ranch, the two brothers live alone on this ranch with a lot of male ranch hands who follow every single thing Benedict Cumberbatch says.
And
Jesse Plemons is very much...
And he's a very good rancher with a very strict way of doing things, especially as it pertains to sick animals. That's a big big part of his ethos.
Yeah, he doesn't... If cow has anthrax, it's anathema. We don't touch it. Get away. But they do have a couple of women who work there, but they're the help. So this is...
I got a little buzz
Whitney.
In my... Sorry.
Honestly, priorities. But this is about what happens when... a bunch of men get together and dominate the land together, and there are no women around to change that dynamic. And what happens when Jesse Plemons meets and falls in love with a widow, played by Kirsten Dunst. She has a teenage son, played by Cody Smit McPhee. And he marries her, and he takes her back home, and Benedict Cumberbatch wants none of this. And he starts undermining her in sometimes subtle, sometimes very obvious ways, in ways that would remind me very, very much of Alfred Hitchcock's Rebecca.
But none of them in a way where he's doing anything aggressive toward her. It's not like in Baby Jane where he's like serving her rats or something. But,
no. It's all the kind of thing where like if you complained to someone, here's what he's doing. Every time I see him, he whistles this same song. It doesn't sound that bad. Mm-hmm. But in the context of their relationship and what he knows it means, it becomes this like... sort of
it's an intimidation tactic.
It's become this anthem of cruelty. Mm. So, like, and it's really starting to mess with their mind.
And it's not just about his toxic masculinity and how he's rejecting sort of the entrance of the feminine into this space. It's very much about just sort of gender roles in general.
Yeah.
Because the Kirsten Dunst character is also feeling a great pressure to be a homemaker now. She's married. I think she's married her second husband.
Yeah, her first
husband. Is Cody Smit McPhee's father. And
yeah,
he's dead. So now she's married her second husband, and she's expected by Jesse Plemons to be a little bit more of an entertaining lady.
Yeah, one of the
that
first
is
things...
will entertain company. And
We're rich, and every once in a while, famous people will stop by the ranch, and I want you to be able to play piano for them.
There's this
and
big...
he's very encouraging. He's not bitter about it, but there's still a lot of pressure he's putting on her.
Well, he's definitely putting pressure on her, and she's clearly not in a position where she keeps on saying, I only played piano for movies. It's the 20s, and you know there were silent movie houses, and you're just sort of plinking stuff out there. It's not important what the tune is.
Yeah.
I don't really know how to... like play a nice piece for people.
I'm not good is what she wants.
So she's under this tremendous pressure. And she begins drinking, as an alcoholic would. She hides booze around the house, and doesn't want anybody to know that she's drinking. But Benedict Cumberbatch sees that and uses it as more of this kind of intimidation leverage. Again, he's not trying to achieve anything through
this. He doesn't have a specific goal other than making sure she's unwelcome, and if somehow that all conspires to have her leave, run away, drink herself to death, he'll be fine with it. Like, however that works out, he'd probably be okay.
Jane Campion has made... I'm not a huge Jane Campion deep diver. I've seen like four of her movies.
Yeah.
She's very good. I've seen Holy Smoke. I saw Portrait of a Lady. I really like Holy Smoke.
I saw the piano. Yeah.
A lot of her films tend to be about gender power dynamics. And never has that been in stronger display than in The Power of the Dog. Because it's all about gender power dynamics and sexuality and how people are wielding these subtle bits of power over one another in a way that is just, it feels like the birth of like fascist, like mind thinking, fascist thing, sort of like the origin of that rather than using these tactics in order to break something or overpower someone.
There's a quality to this film I really like, where even though it's in the 1920s, and you know, it mostly takes place on this ranch, we don't see a lot of what we consider to be 1920s civilization. You know, cars, movie houses.
It's in a rural area.
It's very rural. It's so rural that if you could see vast swaths of the movie and not know what era it is. Mm. And I think that works very much in the film's favor because there's a certain timelessness to this that I think makes it extra powerful. This ends up having the quality of a Greek tragedy or a Gothic novel. It really does feel like the kind of story that you probably read in English class. Like this was like a required reading kind of thing. I know it's based on a 1960s novel, but this takes on this like epic quality, even though it's very, very intimate. The movies I was thinking about most when I was watching this, and these are good movies to think about when you're watching another movie, are Days of Heaven, another great doomed romance, you know, tragedy, set in the early 20th century, and as I said, Rebecca, which is another story about a woman moving into a house where some people there do not want them,
and it takes on
an increasingly cruel, wicked quality. And I love where the power of the dog goes, and I love where you start, without ruining where the plot goes, as you start picking up on nothing in this movie is in here by accident. Every single thing is very particular. And as a result, once we start seeing certain things in the movie and you start thinking to yourself, well, that's in there for a reason. Oh shit. Okay, let's do this.
You're alluding to something that I think I can describe, the relationship between the Benedict Cumberbatch character and the Cody Smith McPhee character.
Yeah.
He reads as queer. He steps on screen. Benedict Cumberbatch, I think, even calls him like a fancy lad.
Initially,
that's part of his rejection, is he's also rejecting this element of queerness that's entered this space.
When we first see Cody Smith McPhee in the movie, I think it's like the first scene or first shot in the film, he is making paper flowers. And they look really good, actually. It's like they're really nicely done. And Kirsten Dunst's like, oh, those are lovely. We can use those on the table at this like bed and breakfast that we own. And Benedict Cumberbatch and his ranchers go there for a meal. And Benedict Cumberbatch looks at the flowers and he starts fondling them in a very sensual way. Like, oh, whichever lady made these is the lady for me. And then Cody McPhee says, oh, I made those. And you can just see Benedict Cumberbatch's face goes, I did not want to have to think about this right now. And I am going to get very shitty to you immediately. And indeed he does.
This is a story about those like intimidation, but it goes in a way where you're not going to expect it. And it doesn't come into a head the way you're going to expect it to. And it sort of crests in a much gentler, more humane way than you're going to expect it to. Even though I think there's still a lot of acid and dark feelings and alcoholism.
There's definitely a way this could have gone that could have been like a Tales from the Crypt episode.
Yeah, and it
never goes that far.
It doesn't go that way. Gene Campion is an incredibly deliberate director, but you wouldn't know it by looking. By that I mean...
You wouldn't know it until it all comes together.
Exactly. You said earlier that nothing's in this movie by accident, and it all feels very natural to the point where you think some of it is very incidental. But Jane Campion is too masterful a director to have something like that be incidental. Everything does build to something.
Yeah.
She's really thought this out, and it is impeccably made.
Its
point of introducing this element of toxic masculinity, it essentially the end of the Western, this is already the 20th century, is a wonderful genre breakdown. Benedict Cumberbatch is pretty amazing in this role.
This is his best role I've ever seen him do.
Because I can see somebody like a little bit more of a tough guy, somebody like Tom Hardy, say, who can play a heavy, take on a role like this and have him be a little bit more of a brute. And while Benedict Cumberbatch is brutish, I think he's able to bring a lot more humanity than a more brutish actor might have.
Well, he never goes for... It would have been so easy with this role, as someone who is being psychologically abusive, to add an element of physicality to it. Maybe not physical abuse, but physical intimidation.
Like, he's a tall guy, but he doesn't ever... Yeah, like...
He never looms, he never threatens, he doesn't have to. There's something about that. There's something about the brightness of intelligence that he has, where he is calculating, that makes his character that much more weird in a way. And I mean that in a sort of a, almost in a complimentary way. And he's there's something like deeply wrong with him as his soul. And as the story progresses and you realize kind of where he comes from and where his actual sympathies and where his ego comes from, you start to realize that that comes from a place of great fragility, or at the very least perceived fragility, and a place of great loneliness for him. And there almost comes a point where you wonder, maybe this is going to be a story about Benedict Cumberbatch's unlikely redemption. No. This is not a happy story. I will say that. This is a very, very acidic story. I really love this movie. This is a spectacularly well-crafted piece of cinema. And
it's incredibly thoughtful. Impeccable is the word I used. Mm-hmm. And it's salient and timely. I feel like these sorts of movies that are using genre tropes to take on things that we kind of take for granted out of certain genres, the masculinity in Westerns. The masculinity in Westerns is taken down pretty often, but I feel like
masculinity in Westerns has been taken down in Westerns since the first half of the 20th century. Yeah, like, Cimarron was talking about that, for God's sake.
Ultimately, I think Cimarron, unfortunately, kind of lionized the bastard hero a little bit too much, but...
But look where he ends up.
He ends up... If I can spoil Cimarron, a movie from the 30s.
First Western to win the Academy Award for Best Picture.
He ends up dead, but lionized, and the whole city is named after him. So,
yeah, but nobody knows. The whole city is named after him, but he dies in the city alone and forgotten as a homeless person because there's no place for that. Because
he had wanderlust.
We idolize this kind of frontiersman kind of persona, but... there's no place for them in the world anymore.
I hate that his wife, who... there's a big portion of that movie where she's taking charge of all of his businesses.
Uh-huh.
She's in charge of the family.
Yeah.
She's the leader of everything now. Yeah. And she gets, no credit for any of that.
Well, anytime he comes home, I was gone for 6 years. I had wanderlust. What can I do? And I'm glad I came back when I did, because you were about to screw everything up. I'm a man. Fix everything. I'll see you in 12 years.
I was doing fine. Get the F out of here.
Cimarron is not a very good film.
No, it isn't.
Yeah, it's for its time, it was technologically innovative. Nowadays, we take a lot of its innovations for granted. But that actually is a good point, though. The Western genre, it can be very, very dated if you're not very, very careful with it. Even when you're trying to say something very modern with it, you're still kind of trapped in that past. And I think... by isolating this story and by making it more of an intimate tale of personalities in conflict, by making it very, very, very specific, I think Jane Campion has crafted something deeply universal, and I really, really want people to see this movie.
It's on Netflix.
Yeah.
If you have a Netflix subscription, you can see it. Definitely see it. It's a slow burn kind of film. It's pretty, pretty quiet.
Yeah.
It's not like The Harder They Fall, where there's going to be there's no guns fired in this. It's not that kind of Western.
I don't think so. Yeah.
No, nobody has. They're ranchers. They don't have guns.
Yeah.
It's not even like, oh, and then other ranch is trying to take over.
Yeah.
Nothing contrived that. It's all about character. It's all about moments. It's all about little tiny subtle moments. So be sure to really, really dig into this one.
Yeah.
I really loved it too.
There's only one other movie this week, bless you, that we have both seen. And it is a new Paul Verhoeven joint.
Yay.
Paul Verhoeven is a filmmaker who has never shied away from controversy. from anything, I guess is the right word. Never shied away from controversy. Even when he's making movies, he got his start in Europe making films that are very much about sex and violence. And then when he moved to America and started making American movies, he made these big, epic, expensive blockbusters. And instead of making them for everyone, he pumped them full of sex and violence.
More sex and violence.
RoboCop is... you saw what happened when they tried to remake a RoboCop for modern audiences. That did not. It was not the same thing.
Yeah, remember when they remade RoboCop?
Remember when they remade Total Recall?
Remember when you forgot about how they remade Total Recall?
Yeah.
Paul Verhoeven understands something fundamental about what goes into movies.
Uh-huh.
Sex and violence.
Yeah.
He likes sex and violence.
But he doesn't like sex and violence on a superficial level.
No, and I was going to say, he puts sex and violence always to a point, except when he makes Showgirls.
Damn it.
Showgirls is supposed to be this
not a good film.
No, it's supposed to be a treatise on modern fame, but it is a crappy flick. I love it, but it's crappy.
Showgirls started off being underrated because everyone called it the worst thing ever made. Mm. And then it started getting kind of overrated because it's still not that fun. Mm. But it's an okay watch if you don't mind that it's really kind of weird and bad.
Did you ever see You Don't Know Me, the documentary about sort of the arc of Showgirls?
I didn't see the arc. Okay, I didn't see that.
It's a documentary about the cult of Showgirls and how they started, like, near the end of the film, they tried to, like, kind of rescue it. No, it's actually saying these really important things, and it's actually trying to... And then they have some critics saying, no, it's fun because it's bad.
Yeah.
It's still bad.
I feel the same way about Showgirls that I do about Halloween 3. Mm. It's the people saying it got kind of a raw deal were right, but... They overdid it a smidge.
It's not defended as a great work of art.
It's just kind of weird and interesting.
It's entertaining, but it's still bad. Paul Verhoeven just loved to swing for the walls. He made these really sort of broad satires that attacked a lot of fundamental institutions.
Yeah.
In this case, he's going the Ken Russell route, and he is attacking the Catholic Church.
This is Ken Russell written all over it in Sharpie.
Yeah, I so love that a Paul Verhoeven movie is coming out this year. When you know, every couple of months on Twitter, you're going to have some prude come out about against sex scenes in movies, like, oh, they're not necessary, we don't need to see them. And he says, well, okay. How about a movie with a Virgin Mary sex toy? It's like, oh, well. Throws a little grenade into that conversation. Yeah. So this takes place in a nunnery in France.
In the 17th century.
In the 17th century. And the Mother Superior, played by Charlotte Rampling, has Benedetta under her charge.
Benedetta is, when we meet her, she's a young girl. She's
played
very,
by an actress named Virginie Efira.
As an adult, she is. When we meet her as a young girl, she's very pious. She sees visions of God, and she speaks to the Virgin Mary and to Jesus Christ.
And her visions of Jesus Christ are superhero fantasies.
Oh yeah, like she envisions like men are attacking her, and Jesus comes in and like chops their heads
off, like on a white horse holding a sword and decapitates bad guys. Like that's how she envisions Jesus.
Yeah, we cut to a few years later, and you got to remember that joining a nunnery at the time wasn't really like, oh, I just feel the call. I feel like I should go here. Mm. Oftentimes it was, our family has too many children, we can just sell this one off. Basically, we're going to give take this child off our hands, take some money. And there's a moment where the father's coming in. It's like, oh, yeah, we'd like to give you our daughter, Benedetta. And Charlotte Rampling is just like, how much are you going to give us for her?
Look, we're looking after her. We need like resources to feed and house these people.
They have to haggle. Cut to about 10, 15 years later, Benedetta's a young nun. And one day while her father is visiting... a young woman is fleeing her abusive and horrifically abusive father.
That's Bartolomea.
And she basically begs for asylum. And Charlotte Rampling says, yeah, this is the Catholic Church. We don't do that. And she's just like, but what do I do here? And then Benedetta basically begs her father to chip in some money and let this young woman stay here and protect her. And they immediately want to fuck each other.
It's pretty clear. Bartolomea is keyed into it immediately.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, Benedetta. Yeah, we're going to be lovers.
Yeah.
Benedetta, she still has it for Jesus.
Yeah, initially.
And she has been interpreting her sexual drive toward Jesus.
Yeah. And she's been interpreting that as visions from God. Her sexual drive, she thinks of as visions from God.
Yeah.
It's... pretty much just a sex drive.
And there's a lot of, and this is like something out of like some softcore Eurosleaze film from the 70s.
Nunsploitation is an actual genre.
They're rooming together and they're like, they have to undress in front of each other and they can see through this diaphanous sheet that hangs between them. Oh, I can kind of see your nude body. And
yeah, there's a scene where Bartolomea almost falls in the shower in the water closet or whatever. And she like almost falls through this thin sheet and like, Benedetta catches her, but like puts her hand on her stomach and her like breasts are right in her face. She's like, oh my. And you're just sort of like, yeah, okay.
Yeah,
Way to go, Paul.
We know what's going on here. Yeah. And
subtle work.
Benedetta might have a plot of some kind.
Mm.
Or perhaps not. Perhaps
the character, not the movie. The movie obviously has
a plot. The character. She
The question is, she
awakens after having one of her spells, one of her visions, and she has wounds on her hands and her feet, and she has scratches on her forehead. She has the stigmata. Which is a sign of divine touch. If you don't know the stigmata, it's...
St. Francis of Assisi, the wounds that Christ received on the cross, according to the New Testament. He received wounds on... According to most Catholic imagery...
It's in on his the palms hands, of your hands.
But actuality, they wouldn't nail you to a cross in your palms because they wouldn't hang.
Your hands would rip.
They would probably be more on your wrist, but whatever. People didn't know that.
Hands, feet, the spear wound in under the ribs.
Crown of thorns.
And the crown of thorns, the scratches on the head. Those are all... Yeah.
Have you ever saw the movie Stigmata with Patricia Arquette?
I don't know.
It's okay.
Stigmata is a piece of crap. It's a bad movie.
I find it entertaining.
Okay.
It's a corker. It's kind of weird.
I'm just going to spoil the ending of Stigmata for you because you're not going to see that movie. Patricia Arquette gets the stigmata wounds and is also like possessed.
She's possessed by a saintly person who may also be evil but may not.
Yeah.
The movie wants to treat getting this. The idea is that Patricia Arquette gets the stigmata even though she's just a workaday person who isn't even pious.
Yeah.
And then Gabriel Byrne is supposed to come in and check out. He's like the guy that works at the Vatican to see if miracles are real. Usually they're not. And he goes up and says, you shouldn't have the stigmata. You're not even religious. And she's like, yeah, I know, it sucks, right? But she keeps getting the stigmata, and really scary shit happens. And they try to treat getting the stigmata as this, like, exorcist horror movie thing.
Yeah, it's like a demon possession
thing. But, like,
thing.
The movie can't tell if it's trying to be religious or horrifying, and I find that kind of fascinating. Also, there's this really weird bit where, like, they're on the subway, and they reused some shots of the subway, of the runaway subway from the end of Money Train. So the train is all, like, kind of got, like, the battle damage that it does in the movie Money Train, even though it's just a train. It makes no sense.
I didn't see Money Train, so...
Money Train's fun.
Okay.
This is the Money Train podcast now.
back to Paul Verhoeven.
Paul Verhoeven's Money Train.
Benedetta, immediately, Mother Superior says, if she's getting the stigmata, she is more pious than me, and I'm going to step aside as Mother Superior, even though we can't really be sure what's going on here. If she's got those wounds... Whether or not they're fake, we have to sort of defer to the power of the church.
Yeah.
And of course, the church officials move in
right
through the plague-ridden town outside, perhaps carrying the plague inside. They're carrying the plague inside.
Yeah.
To investigate and also figure out whether or not this Benedetta figure is as pious as she says.
Meanwhile, Benedetta is either the cleverest saint in history... The cleverest con person in history, or she's letting power go to her head and she's just using this as an excuse to fuck. Paul Verhoeven allows all of those things to be possible simultaneously.
All of those things
could be true by the end of this movie, and I love that.
And I love the way it ends as well. And
yeah,
I'm not
going to
say how it kind of goes.
Oh, it's satisfying.
It doesn't quite go as wild as something like The Devils. Nothing can, really. But it does have that very deep criticism of the Catholic Church as a power organization rather than an organization about piety or morality.
Mm-hmm. There's at least two characters in this movie who have a death scene that I can only imagine most actors would kill for. Like, it's
or die for.
Like, this builds so beautifully. It starts off kind of like just interesting period piece. Then it gets kind of prurient and nunsploitation, and not in a bad way, but in an in your face kind of way.
We can just say that Paul Verhoeven isn't afraid to put sex on film. That's something that we don't see a lot in American cinema in general.
That's true.
And especially not within the last, like, 10 or 15 years or so.
But for a little bit, it's hard to tell if he has more on his mind than just, what if people were sexually repressed and trapped in a room together and really wanted to bone? And that would be enough for some filmmakers. But Paul Verhoeven is a smart filmmaker, and he uses all of that to weave what is increasingly... like Power of the Dog, it's another period piece that kind of turns into kind of a Greek tragedy at the end, where everything feels like it is all built up to this gigantic crescendo where the wicked are destroyed and the faithless regain faith and the people who had faith lose their faith. And everything is just really, really big, but everything feels incredibly earned.
Oh, yeah.
The performances in this movie are really, really great. In particular, I think Charlotte Rampling is just killing it here. And I'm actually, not that I try not to be that guy who talks about like award stuff. I'm surprised we're not talking about her more in the awards conversation. Yeah, she's got a good role too. She's got like a really showy Oscar-y role too. And she's killing it here. She's fantastic in this movie.
Because she's the one who is also sort of trying to see things from two moral perspectives and is actually holding both of them at the same time. Like this could be real, it could be not, but here's the appropriate course of action.
Yeah.
She actually has a good deal of authority, but she's not a... And even though she's, you know, a stern mother superior figure, she's not overbearing or overpowering.
No. She makes some very bad decisions in here, and she pays for them, and she realizes what she did.
Yeah.
And she's fantastic. Everyone's good in this movie. Yeah. Everyone is good in this movie.
We didn't credit the new novice, Bartolomeus, played by Daphne Patakia. She's a Greek actress. I don't know her.
Was she an L?
Oh, was she? I think she
might have been an L.
Maybe, which was Paul Verhoeven's last... I think it was his last
movie. Regardless, this is a movie that I think initially when it was like being announced and stuff, it was being kind of written off as, oh, Paul Verhoeven's just being his controversial, he's going to make a sexy nun movie.
He's 83, he's just being prurient.
Is he 83? Holy shit. Okay, well, in any case, he's just making a sexy nun movie to make a sexy nun movie. And... I think people who were saying that weren't giving him enough credit here because this is one of the best movies of the year for me.
Yeah,
I think this movie is not only is it just fantastically entertaining, but it's actually got some real depth to it. Yeah, and it's really, really good.
It's got some real depth to it. I admire that it is prurient.
Yeah, it's important that it is. It actually like supports the story and makes it more interesting because you understand where these characters are coming from.
The steam and the sexuality is an important part of it. Same with the fascism in Starship Troopers or the violence in RoboCop. That's actually a big important parts of those films. Mm-hmm. They actually play into the texture and the tone and the themes of those movies.
Yeah,
and I feel like if
RoboCop is less violent, RoboCop is less powerful,
less effective.
If Starship Troopers has less fascistic, if you can miss the fascistic undertones in that movie, then that movie
is
merely fascist. It's not actually a satire of fascism. And here, if you removed the sexuality or if you toned it as far down as you could possibly go, you're going to end up with a stuff that's more about the principle of the thing than it is about the human drive to be sensual, to be sexual, and to still, especially in a repressed society, be sexual beings and also have faith.
Mm-hmm.
You can have both. It's not about like, I will destroy the church because they won't let us fuck. Mm-hmm. No, I want to fuck,
but I also want to be part of the church.
I want to be able to do both things. And
this is exploring that space where where does fucking Catholicism overlap? I'm not going to call the film horny because I think that's deflection. Mm-hmm. It's a film that's made to make you horny. I feel the same way about a film that came out earlier this year, which is far more lascivious. It's The Voyeurs. Yeah,
it's the only other horny movie that came out this year, really.
I know, right? Like these are movies that are just loaded with sex and nudity, and the sex and nudity is actually kind of a big selling point. It's a big part of it.
Yeah,
and I don't want to sound prurient, but it is something I've missed from cinema.
Yeah.
Sex is a big, important part of a lot of human interaction, and it's a big part of repression as the church has it. And I think that it's kind of important that we put that in movies from time to time.
And I think it's worth noting that, yes, it is entirely possible to tell great stories without being sexually explicit or overt. Many have been.
Mm.
And indeed, there's a lot of people who are asexual or have different sexual levels or desires, and making movies that are not intensely sexual is more inviting, or at least it connects more to a lot of people. But there are still a lot of people who are driven by their sexual desires, whether they like it or not, and we need to be able to make movies about that. If you make a movie like that and you remove the capacity to show, to illustrate those carnal needs, you are not going to be able to tell that story as well. This is a great example of how to do it.
Here's where we are. This year, I didn't watch the series, but I was familiar with the moment. I saw the scene in question. It was called Loki. It's a Marvel series. And there's a bit where somebody's talking about You've had a lot of partners in your life. You've had some princesses and maybe some princes, and Loki kind of winks and says, yes, a little bit of both. And we've been so starved for, in this case, bisexual representation, that this little tiny crumb was feasted upon.
Yeah.
Without the sex in the movies,
yeah,
we're not getting a full gamut of representation.
I just want to say something. This is not an important point, but I do want to bring it up. A lot of people are talking about how, oh, there's no sex in any of the Marvel movies. That is not strictly true.
There was one in Eternals. There was a sex scene.
Before that.
All right.
Everyone's like, oh, Eternals. It's like the first one. Like, Incredible Hulk.
Okay.
There's a great scene in Incredible Hulk where Ed Norton and Liv Tyler, they've reunited, and Ed Norton has, you know, he's trying to cure himself of this horrible monster.
The Hulk disease. Yeah.
And there's a scene where they are so into each other and they're so in lust that they're trying to rip each other's clothes off, and then his heart rate monitor goes up. And they have to, like, stop, and it's, like, really awkward.
Oh, that's right.
And he's like, I'm sorry, we can't do this. And she's like,
let's just go
at all? Like, that was actually, like, a scene of, like, you have that in there, but you were getting out of that sex scene in a way that fit the plot,
fit the
characters, was kind of funny.
And it can
be done.
In Iron Man, we didn't get to see the scene, but Leslie Bibb wakes up in bed after a night of wild passion. But
it's not just the same.
No, it's definitely not the same. And when we're not having sex in movies, we're not having proper representation in movies, especially queer representation. So a film with queer sex that actually has queer sex in it, I think, is kind of important.
Agreed.
And it's okay to be lascivious from time to time, because that's a part of us, so long as you're not being a sleaze about it. And Paul Verhoeven isn't being a sleaze about it, except when he's making Showgirls. Showgirls is like the big misstep in everybody's career.
Yeah. Is there anyone for whom Showgirls is a highlight?
Gina Gershon.
She still got Bound, though.
Yeah, but
Bound is the highlight.
Yeah, but she's living in that movie. She prowls. The movie.
She deserves so much better. All right. Well, let's give Benedetta a hand. Very nice.
Oh no, you're doing a transition, aren't you?
The Hand of God.
Oh my God.
It's a new film from Paolo Sorrentino, or as I like to call him, the other Fellini.
Yeah, or just Fellini.
At this point.
Many people have compared Paolo Sorrentino to Federico Fellini. With good cause. He's trying to make Fellini movies.
Basically, yes.
He has the same obsessions with Fellini that Fellini had. And he is also obsessed with Fellini. Fellini made a lot of movies about young men and their sexuality, aging men and their sexuality. Anything that allowed him to contain acres of décolletage, as it were.
Excess. That's what he was all about. He had a lot of excess.
A lot of excess. And there were also, there were always very, like, psychologically personal films, Fellini.
Yeah.
Whether or not they were about Fellini, they always were, like, sort of in Fellini's mind, or about Fellini's wife. Who starred in all of his movies, and she's really wonderful. But
we both fun because for whatever reason, Whitney and I just aren't big Fellini fans.
I like some Fellini movies. I don't need to, like, sort of run out and grab his box sets. I've been meaning to give 8.5 another chance, because it's a movie you and I both notoriously dislike.
Fellini is one of those filmmakers where I've tried watching his movies multiple times. I've seen multiple ones of his films, and I don't know if I'm picking the wrong films or what, but every single time I watch a Fellini film, I'm like, I'm good. I'm not intrigued enough to see more. I always feel like I see what you're doing.
You might like what was it called? Evitaloni. Evitaloni is maybe one of the less Fellini movies, where he's actually a little bit more of a natural style. His films are actually pretty stylistic. He likes a lot of artificiality. Rather famously, and this was actually common European practice at the time, he recorded a lot of his films without sound, and then had the actors come back and dub their own lines later, giving it this weird dreamlike quality. He liked that, sometimes doing it even for films that weren't going to get international distribution, which they were going to dub anyway.
Yeah.
So it actually made a lot more financial sense to shoot films without sound.
Yeah, that was incredibly common.
This film, The Hand of God is Paolo Sorrentino's I Vitelloni, huh? In that he's trying to make a little bit more of a naturalist film, where it actually doesn't have a very pointed story. It's actually, it's part I Vitelloni, and I'm also going to compare it to Kenneth Branagh's Belfast from earlier this year, in that it is also semi-autobiographical about the filmmaker's own childhood, or in this case, teenage years. There's a young man who is sort of the Paolo Sorrentino stand-in. Let me look at the character's name. His character is Fabietto. He's played by a guy named Filippo Scotti. And this is a story about him and his family. And his family is this large, colorful cast of characters. There's people who sort of... people, and there's a lot of scenes of them just sort of hanging out at the and having dinner. Or hanging out on the beach. Or going on a boat ride. And we just sort of get to see a lot of them interacting. The center of his universe are his mom and his dad. Mm-hmm. Who are the ones giving him kind of the most moral guidance. They also seem to be the most sort of laid back and grounded of this sort of wild cast of characters. So he's getting a lot of this wild energy from his extended family. He's getting a lot of more grounded energy from his parents. And we sort of get to see, as you know, time passes, how their relationships evolve. His mother and his father aren't always on the best of terms. And something very dramatic happens partway through the movie that changes his relationship with his mother and his father very dramatically. I'm not going to say what that thing is.
It's also rhymes about... with Blair Wolf. They get attacked by a Blair Wolf.
There are no werewolves in The Hand of God.
Why are we watching that?
I try to say that this is maybe sort of skewing away from the Fellini aspect, like the inspirations that Paolo Sorrentino takes from Fellini. But they're in production of a Fellini film in the course of this movie. Fellini's not a character in it. He may as well have been, but there's another famous Italian filmmaker that Paolo Sorrentino studied under who is a character in this movie that the young protagonist takes a few important life lessons from right at the very end. There's actually a really good, wonderful confrontation between the young character and this filmmaker sort of teacher of his on a beach where they kind of trade some pretty harsh truths in a shouting match. And it's also about this young man sort of traversing the Italian countryside in the 1980s, of course, exploring his sexuality. And he has various crushes on various hot women who wear diaphanous skirts on beach fronts. And it's Paolo Sorrentino, so you know he's going to shoot the living fuck out of this thing. Everything's just really sumptuous and gorgeously shot, and everything's really laid out very well. So it's all very, very sensual and energetic. And I kind of appreciate that it is a little bit aimless. It actually is just about the string of experiences that this young man is having on his way to growing up. And it's not about a final confrontation. It's not about a plot. Nothing dramatic is happening in the country. He is just living his life. And that's really out of character for someone like Paolo Sorrentino. I've seen his film The Great Beauty, which I wasn't a big fan of.
All right.
I saw his film Loro, which is about Silvio Berlusconi.
Didn't see that.
Which, you know, it's kind of well-suited because if you know anything about Silvio Berlusconi, he was sort of this very Trumpian figure who didn't have a lot of political experience. He was much more of like a schmoozer, and that sort of argues that his, you know, his power...
Posting on charm, yeah.
He tried to sort of schmooze his way into high office and thinks that's where the ultimate party is, and... Silvio Berlusconi rather infamously had what he called Bunga Bunga parties. Look up what those are because it's disgusting. And I saw his film Youth, and I think Youth is his best film.
I actually like Youth. I don't love it, but I think Michael Caine anchors that movie in a lot of quality character work.
I think it's about aging men finally putting a lot of those more lascivious impulses behind them.
Yeah.
There's a really wonderful scene in that movie where Michael Caine and his best friend are sitting there. It takes place at like the spa, and he's in a big hot tub with his best friend. And this gorgeous young woman comes out and she throws her robe off and gets into the water nude. And they're just sort of looking at her and they're like, "Yeah, we're done." Like that's really beautiful, isn't it? Yeah, of course she's beautiful. But what are we gonna do? We're 80. You know, that time is over for us. And I like that sort of Coda feel of Youth. And this is a little bit more of the same kind of gentle attitude, just about sort of starting out. There are some lascivious moments I don't like. There's a scene where the young protagonist has an encounter with an older woman who sort of takes her a position as sort of like his sexual teacher. And I've seen that kind of scene in so many exploitation movies that it feels kind of worn out here.
Yeah.
Whether or not that was true to life, it feels really cliche to me. I didn't like that scene, just personally. Yeah. I appreciate that he's trying to tone it down a little bit. And I appreciate that he's trying to aim a little bit lower and go for something a little bit more true to life. There's still a lot of those Fellini markers. And yeah, they are there. There's a scene where he's leaning into a room and they're talking about producing a Fellini movie and putting all the pictures of the potential stars up on a bulletin board.
And to be fair, a lot of people really like Fellini. We consider this as maybe a negative. It's going to be a positive for a lot of people. Yeah. There's a reason why Sorrentino is as acclaimed as he is. A lot of people do like this stuff.
And so as such, there's a few scenes that kind of tip into the fantastic. Which are interesting, but I feel like they're distracting from the grounded nature of the movie. So it's a little bit neither here nor there in certain sequences, but overall it's pretty good.
Okay, well that's good, and I'll try to get around to seeing it. Paolo Sorrentino is this filmmaker. I respect what he does, because I get what he's doing, and I know he's doing it really well, but thus far, with the somewhat exception of Youth, which does it too, but I think gets away with it better.
Mm-hmm.
When I finish watching Paolo Sorrentino Joint, I get the feeling that my opinion of the movie doesn't matter, because the movie is so unbelievably fucking proud of itself. Like, it's just like, look what we did! And I'm like, yeah, okay, cool. Does my opinion matter? No!
I saw what you did.
Yeah.
I'm not impressed.
No. Like, Paolo Sorrentino, just the act of making the movie was enough for him. Like, he's just like, so every single sequence in The Great Beauty, for example, just feels completely self-congratulatory to me. And it just rubs me the wrong way. If the movie was a person, I wouldn't want to hang out with them. That's what it boils down to.
Yeah.
It's just a personality clash. Doesn't mean they're a bad person. Doesn't mean they're a bad movie. It just means that we are not on the right same wavelength at all.
I find it interesting that, There's a lot of, like, sex and nudity in this film, because it is about a young man sort of discovering sexuality. There's sex and nudity in this film. There's sex and nudity in Benedetta. Those are European movies. There's not a lot of American films that are doing that. So I'm appreciative of at least that aspect, the frankness of it.
All right. Speaking of young men coming to terms with et cetera. I didn't see the Paolo Sorrentino movie. I'm trying to find narrative tissue here.
All right.
Let's talk about the documentary Torn.
Tell me about Torn, because I didn't see this.
Torn is a new documentary about a subject about which I know next to nothing that I haven't learned from a Sylvester Stallone movie. It's about mountain climbing.
Okay.
Torn.
Have you ever gone scrambling or anything?
No, I was never very good at it. I could barely climb a tree even when I was like a spry little kid. I was never really good at it. It's fine. Just wasn't for me. I'm not afraid of heights, but I respect that they could kill me, so I stay away.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm not afraid of snakes, but I'm not going to go just like hang out with a whole bunch of cobras, like in a pit. Mm. And be like, hey, cobras, what's up? Like, I'm not going to do that with mountain climbing either. That's where I'm at with this.
I'll go to a high spot. I just don't want to fall off.
Well, exactly. And I don't want to put myself... I want to minimize the odds of me doing that to zero, if possible, please. So I'm just not going to do that. But I wouldn't say I'm, like, paranoid of heights. I digress.
But this is all about heights.
Well, sort of. Torn is the story of a real-life mountain climber. His name was Alex Lowe. And in the... Actually, I'm a little hazy on the era here. But in the 90s, maybe even the 80s... there was a big boom in mountain climbing as the sort of extreme sports started becoming more popularized and becoming a little bit more mainstream. And Alex Lowe was considered one of the best.
Okay.
One of the best mountain climbers in the world. It was his passion. It was his drive. He spent most of his time, most of his year, mountain climbing all over the world. Much to the chagrin of his family, who were basically sitting at home, the kids... Three sons, didn't really spend a lot of time with their dad.
Mm.
And his wife, Jennifer, knew what she was getting into. She knew that this is who he was. And initially, she never even thought of him as marriage material because of this. But she fell in love with them. They got married. And initially, for like 7 years when they were married before they had kids, it was fine. They traveled the world and everything was great. But when they started having children, he started getting... torn. He started having that wanderlust we talked about, okay, where he could stay home with the kids, but the longer he stayed home with the kids, the more irritable he got, the more nervous and antsy he got, and he needed to just go climb a fucking thing. In around 1999, he was in Nepal, and he got caught in an avalanche and died.
Oh, rest in peace.
Indeed. Great tragedy. Made all the papers and everything. He was a big figure. I was unaware of it because I wasn't following mountain climbing, but he was a big deal. This documentary is directed by his eldest son, Max. And it is not so much about him as a great mountain climber. Mm-hmm. It's about what happens when you're a great mountain climber and you really didn't focus on your family very, very much. And now you're dead from mountain climbing and your family has to figure out what the fuck to do. So it's about three sons who are now adults, and they're all like a little bitter and confused, you know, about like who their father was. What did he actually represent to them? And then it turns out his father's best friend, another mountain climber, started helping out with the family more and more. Like, you know, if I had died, I'd want him to help out, you know, with anyone I left behind. And then he fell in love with their mom, and then they got married. And now they have this other mountain climber for a dad, and they don't know how much to accept him. And the more you watch the movie Torn, the more you realize this isn't about sports, this isn't about mountain climbing. This is about a guy who lost his father at a very young age and is making a documentary trying to figure out who's his real dad.
Oh my goodness, okay.
And on that level, it's a good documentary. I actually do appreciate how probing he is when he's doing interviews, because initially you don't really know, like, this is where the emotional center of the film is. But he's, like, interviewing his mom, and he's interviewing his stepdad. And there's this bit where, like, he's interviewing his stepdad, and they're finally talking about, like, what happened after you realize that you're in love with my mother and everything. And he starts asking questions like, did you ever feel like you were invading the space of your best friend? These kind of weird, like, kind of accusatory, but not direct. No implication of anything negative. There's no Hamlet shit here. Did you kill my dad, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
But it's just like, do you ever feel like a usurper kind of thing?
Yeah.
And you can tell that this guy did nothing wrong. This guy actually, like, was a kind of a weird situation. Hmm. But this guy's actually trying to be a really good father to these kids. And unlike the kid's actual biological father, he put in the work, and even though he still does some mountain climbing, he does a lot less of it, and he's a lot less dangerous about it, and he always prioritizes those kids. And over the course of the film, we just see the documentary filmmaker become more and more comfortable admitting that this other guy is his dad.
Hmm.
And that's kind of beautiful, actually.
Yeah.
I was expecting something a little bit more of a sportsman-like free solo kind of thing about, because mountain climbing, if you think about, we're going to make a movie about a mountain climber. You imagine it's going to have mountain climbing in it, because that's going to be kind of the selling point. And I've seen a lot of really good mountain climbing documentaries. But yeah, this ended up being this kind of like really intimate, almost like a 90s indie drama kind of thing. Like, it could have taken all place. This could have all taken place over the course of a weekend, you know? And you can imagine, like, I don't know, I'm trying to think of who would be, like, Jeremy Davies, like, in the late 90s, like, coming home, unsure how to deal with his dad, who's played by
Gene Hackman or something.
Gene Hackman, and it's just like, yeah,
just
but
for Walken.
Yeah, and then, like, it turns out, like, when he, like, yeah, and, like, Matthew McConaughey's playing the young version of his dad, but then, like, but Matthew McConaughey wasn't big yet, it's kind of weird. Yeah. It's a good little documentary. It's not, like, epic or necessarily profound, but I found myself struck by how increasingly intimate it got over time, which is something movies don't often do.
Yeah.
So I dug it. It's worth checking out. I'm not a big documentary guy in general. I don't, you know, I don't review
sad,
them.
Yeah.
I don't review them a lot. But I was, this one got under my skin a little bit and I quite liked it. So all I'm right. just going to give it a hearty recommendation here. What do you want to tell me about Diary of a Wimpy Kid?
We're talking about jump to Wolf, but all right.
We're talking about kids and stuff. I don't know.
Diary of a Wimpy Kid is, animated film on Disney Plus from director Swinton Scott. I know Swinton Scott because he worked on The Simpsons and Futurama, so he has a little bit of an irreverent sense of humor as a director. This is also the fifth Wimpy Kid film, and only the first one I've seen.
I was about to ask, because I know there have been several live-action
movies. Yeah, there were four live-action Wimpy Kid films.
Is this, like, going right back to square one? Do you have any idea if that's the case?
This is based on the first Wimpy Kid book, and this is the first animated film. It's animated in the style
just a hard reboot,
of the drawings in the Wimpy Kid books. Yeah. Let me look up the author of the Diary of a Wimpy Kid books.
I'll do that while you keep talking about them.
Okay, Jeff Kinney is the name of the author. Right. Jeff Kinney also wrote the screenplay for this. And Diary of a Wimpy Kid, it's a big sensation for, like, elementary school kids.
Mm-hmm.
And there
has been for a while, too.
Yeah, the setup of the books is it is a diary of a ostensibly wimpy kid who is trying to traverse middle school for the first time. He's 11 years old, and he is a little shit. The wimpy kid is a selfish little jerk who is trying to. He's reached the age where he understands what cool is. Cool, that is, the concept of cool. Mm-hmm. He understands that it's important, that it's something he needs. But he's also, and in so doing, has to sort of shake off all of his little kid habits. Like the things he remembers growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And this leads to him really mistreating his best friend, Rowley, who is still enjoying, you know, silly jokes and fart noises and you wearing shirts with unicorns on them. He still likes little kid stuff because he's 11. And 11 can be kind of an awkward age. It's where you're sort of trying to push forward into being an adolescent, but you're not an adolescent quite yet. He's also picked on by the bullies at his school. His school is really awful. One of the central details of his school is that on the blacktop of the basketball court is a piece of cheese that's been there for God knows how long. Nobody has bothered to clean the basketball court, so the slice of cheese has been there, and this has led to a stigma about the cheese touch. If you touch it, you're infected, and you can only get rid of it by touching somebody else, and they have the cheese touch. Rumor has it that somebody was touched, and then they moved to California, so it's gone. I like those little kid details about, you know, the sort of the authenticity of these weird social pressures you go through as a kid. Mm-hmm. In the book Diary of a Wimpy Kid, which I read it to my son, and I actually kind of wish I hadn't because it's a very bitter book.
Oh,
and it's not about how this kid learns lessons. He stays selfish. He mistreats his friend, and enough time passes that his friend kind of comes around again, but he never really thinks to apologize or be a bigger person. He's still 11, and he still has those selfish impulses, and he still doesn't like this kid. In fact, one might see these books as, and this movie, these all go into this movie as well, as maybe an examination of how bullying is passed on. If you are bullied, you in turn often bully others,
yeah,
because that's the social interaction you're used to.
Mm-hmm.
If a bigger kid picks on you, you understand that bigger kids pick on smaller kids. Mm-hmm. So you pick on smaller
kids.
And
that makes the bigger kids feel powerful. And if you want to feel powerful, that's the thing to do it.
Exactly. Yeah. And so this film isn't that thoughtful. This is a 53-minute animated trifle.
Oh,
is
it that
Plus.
Short?
It's only 53 minutes in
length.
Wow. It's almost a TV special.
It is almost a TV special. Wow.
But it has professional production design.
No, it's fine. It's just that's short by any standard. That's like, remember, I guess last year, Host.
58 minutes, but it is under an hour.
Yeah, but that's like Host was that long.
Yeah, it was only about 50 minutes
Which
or
is
so.
Totally fine, by the way, but that's usually like,
I think 40, when was it 40 or 43 where the Academy cuts off feature length?
I think it's 41.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's somewhere around there.
If it's that length, that's still a short. If it's
anything
longer,
over like 40,
then it's a feature. So this is a feature.
Yeah. No, it is totally a feature. But like usually when we think of a feature, I think even when we talk about like, remember back in the golden age of Hollywood when movies were shorter and they crammed so much in, and we're thinking of stuff like Frankenstein, it was 71 minutes. It was still over an hour. So like, I this is not a critique, just sort of a damn.
Yeah.
All right.
And,
cool.
And I feel like this film version, comparing it to the book, actually cuts out a lot. There's entire subplots. Diary of a Wimpy Kid is supposed to be the course of, I think, of a whole year.
Yeah.
And this only covers, like, maybe a couple months. And we get to see, like, sort of what he does on Halloween and how he has to.
Are we sure it's not, like, a pilot or something that they got repurposed?
This was a 20th century animation film that was bought in the Disney fire sale. So this is being dumped onto Disney+.
They might. Oh God, I wonder. I wonder if it's even finished. Like maybe, yeah, maybe it's maybe that short some, because they decided yeah, this, maybe like,
there was they were like still animating
can,
some
can
of
we,
it.
Can we
just
cut some corners?
And just,
yeah, maybe. I don't know. That's a speculation, but
I appreciate the film a little bit more because it actually does have the character sort of having a little bit more of an arc. It actually does end up doing something a little bit noble by the end, which makes for a more satisfying story, even if the books were supposed to be about how he never learns a lesson. But it does still have some of that cynicism and fear and hate that is kind of a vital part of the kid experience. Not the rosier parts, but it's things we encounter as children. And they're dealt with in a little bit of good humor. I just wish maybe it had been a little bit more thoughtful and a little bit less sort of hyperactive in its sort of elements of gross out humor.
Okay. Well, I saw a very different animated film. I saw a Danish film called Flea, which is actually an animated documentary by Jonas Poer Rasmussen. I hope I didn't butcher that too much. And this is a story about a refugee from Afghanistan and how, as a small child, he and his family tried to flee Afghanistan to Russia and then from Russia into Europe. And also how during that time, he started to realize that he was gay in an environment where there wasn't even a word for that. Those are a couple of heavy things happening like right at the same time here. It opens with this young man. His name is Amin, and we actually see the almost the entire movie is animated. The only bits that aren't animated are a couple of like newsreels where sometimes Amin will talk about a historical event or historical time, and we'll see like some clips of like what Americans would have seen on the news, just to give some context, a little broader sociopolitical scope. But the majority of this is animated. Some of it is just rotoscoped. Some of which is clearly they are illustrating and recreating scenes from his childhood where there was no footage.
So
it's a bit of a documentary narrative hybrid there. I find that very exciting. I think we've gotten a little too aggressive with how we decide to categorize things. Like, is this a documentary or is it a narrative film? Yes. It's clearly both. Yeah. It's clearly both things simultaneously. I don't mind what you call it. And I find that very, very intriguing. The more hazy his memory is, the less vividly detailed the animation is.
Okay.
Which is kind of fun. I wish they played more with that, but it is a neat touch and it does give it a little bit of visual vibrancy to it. Yeah, this is just a story of a guy who is talking to a documentary filmmaker about his life. And there's this really great bit at the beginning where he's talking about how he is discussing things that he's never talked about before. Some of which are things that, you know, could have damaged his refugee status. Like, in order to be a refugee in Denmark, he had to say that he was the last surviving member of his family. That was not true. And just admitting that could potentially jeopardize his status as a refugee, his ability to stay in that country. But it's very difficult when watching the movie not to understand exactly why that was completely 100% necessary. Obviously, there's a ton of information out there and about the political upheavals in the Middle East over the course of the 20th century. This is not an informative documentary about all those details. It's a story about very personal experience. Seeing all the different ways that people who are refugees in one country or another are preyed upon by corrupt police, by housing markets, by human traffickers. There's this incredible bit where they're fleeing Russia and they're walking on foot, like across a border. They're going to get on a boat and they're going to be shoved into the bottom of this little rinky dink shitty boat. And they're going to try to travel. And if they get caught, they could get shot and killed. And while they're walking, they realize that one little kid who is, like, on the journey with them has one of those shoes they had in the 90s with the blinky heels. Every time you step, the lights turned on. And there is serious talk about, we got to rip the shoes off of that kid, and that kid's got to walk barefoot, or we got to leave that kid behind, or...
Just the shoes.
It's because it's just a practical consideration, you know. And that's harrowing and horrifying. There's this really sad bit where they're on this boat, and the secret compartment where they're all staying was flooding, so they all had to leave, and they all had to go up, you know, up on the thing. And he's thinking to myself, I'm here with, like, my mom and, like, my brother, and if we go overboard, I can only save one of them. And I kept thinking to myself, which one could I save? And the documentarian's like, could you swim? No, I didn't know how to swim. That did not occur to me at the time. Oh, God. All I could think about was, who would I save? Not about the fact that I have no idea how to do that. But it's also a story about how he's an adult now. And he goes on speaking tours, and he's doing wonderful things with his life. And he's married or engaged to be married to a very nice man. Mm. But he's never spoken of so many things. He talks about, like, when you have to flee from country to country and live on the run and live for fear of being found out your entire life, it affects your capacity for intimacy. It affects your capacity for human interaction. And as happy as he is with this person, there are things he's never told him. And this is another case where it's just like Torn. It takes, like, this big, giant scope of a thing and makes it really intimate and human. And, of course, it is, because it's a human travesty. How difficult it is to be a refugee. It's nonsensical. But it's a really beautiful movie. I highly recommend this film. It's very sweet. I'm trying to think of an example here of, like, an animated movie where it's not quite the same thing, but it's got kind of the same sort of melancholic coming of age tone. I think it's something like Persepolis.
Okay.
That's not a story about a refugee
another,
per se.
Another
but
animated film.
Another animated film. Because, like, I feel like a lot of people, when they think animated films, they have specific ideas. And I think there's a lot of films being made that are kind of redefining or trying to stay on, like, off what we consider to be the normal chart of what an animated movie would be, even animated movies for adults. And I think this is a really potent, really lovely, dramatic story that is told quite nicely through animation.
Who's the director?
The director is Jonas Poer Rasmussen.
Okay. Did you ever see the 2008 film Waltz with Bashir?
No, but I'm aware of it. Yeah,
Waltz
similar,
with Bashir
similar vibe,
is also an animated documentary. That's a war film about Lebanon. It's about Lebanese people. That has, like, a few animated fantastical moments, but they also were able to capture a lot of the horrors of it via animation. Also, I think there was a documentary short film.
Mm.
From a couple of years ago that was animated, but that was about less harrowing subject matter. That was about people who work in grocery stores.
Well, wasn't there like that animated movie about, like, the Bell Tower shooter in Texas?
Oh, I don't remember that one.
Yeah, I can't remember what the hell that one was. It's been done. My point is this. There was some really interesting animated documentary shorts as well that we've reviewed for, like, the Academy Awards. And there was one last year.
I
keep straining at the edges of what we come to expect of the genre, please. It's how the art grows. So this is really wonderful stuff, and I hope people get to see it.
Yeah.
All right, and then lastly, I don't know, tell me about Wolf, I guess. I don't really have... Segways are hard.
Wolf.
Starring Jack Nicholson and James Spader.
No, not to be confused with the 1994 Mike Nichols film.
Which is quite good, actually.
I like that film.
It's pretty cool.
I saw it in a theater as a double feature with The Shadow back
in 1994.
That was a good double feature.
That's a good double feature.
Weird detail about that double feature. They both end with a close-up of a person's face, and the face fades out, and the eyes remain, and then the eyes fade out.
No.
They both end that way.
What are the odds?
Yeah.
That's so weird.
Just by complete coincidence. All right. Yeah, I saw Wolf in the Shadow back to back.
I guarantee you no one planned that. I guarantee you.
This is an Irish film. Okay. It's directed by Natalie Biancheri. I apologize, can't get her name right. And this is about... I think it's a real... It's not like a well-documented real thing, but I think there are some cases of it, of people who suffer from what they call species dysphoria, where they don't feel they're human. They feel that they're animals. But this takes place in sort of a fantasy version of that, where people are... It's about a bunch of young people. They're all young, privileged white people, and that's not really ever really addressed, that the privilege of the people who have this condition. Mm. But they all believe that they're of a different species, and they're being here to... They're at this clinic to be treated and walk their way back to being humans again. And they're encouraged in a very Island of Dr. Moreau way to sort of walk on all fours. You know, what is the law? No spilled blood, that kind of thing. Some of them have earned the privilege to wear sort of animal costumes. One young woman thinks she's a parrot, so she gets to wear a beak. And doctor here, who's believes in sort of tough love, he's played by Paddy Considine, and I love Paddy Considine.
Great actor.
Is trying to sort of force them to realize that they are human. And there's a scene early on where a young man who thinks he's a squirrel is encouraged to climb a tree, ends up injuring his hand because he's not a squirrel. And the main character, he believes he's a wolf. He is a character named Jacob. He's played by George MacKay.
From 1917.
From 1917. He's been around. He was one of the Lost Boys, I believe, in the 2003 Peter Pan.
Oh, okay.
He was in the Sunshine on Leaf movie. He's been around. He's quite a long career. He's a young man. He believes he's a wolf, and he howls at the moon, crawls around on all fours, and the film isn't, even though it has this sort of like quirky setup, there could be something, like if this had been made by the people who made Napoleon Dynamite, this would be milked for all kinds of cheap laughs. But it's not. This is actually sees this dysphoria as something profoundly sad, that they can't connect with the world around them. Something has gone wrong with society, that these people would rather be animals than be people, or feel that they are animals. He ends up connecting with Lily Rose Depp, who plays a young woman who thinks she's a cat or a mountain lion of some kind. And while it's supposed to be intense and maybe kind of romantic and even a little bit sexual, watching them sort of stalk around on all fours and relate to each other in an animalistic sort of way, quite frankly, it looks really silly watching these actors sort of crawl around on all fours pretending to be animals. It feels more like an improv exercise than a proper film. And by the end, we get to see how the Paddy Considine character is getting a little bit more impatient with his patients, how some people are falling further down the rabbit hole, as it were, into believing that they're animals. And I'm not really sure what the filmmaker is getting at about how it might be better to live as an outsider. But if that were the case, wouldn't we learn a little bit more about what the world was like or what these people's lives were like outside of this clinic? Is it more about some sort of great failing of theirs that they're missing some sort of quality in their lives, that they're retreating from their humanity? None of these things are addressed in this movie. It just sort of is a little bit too straightforward in its depiction of all this stuff. It doesn't seem like it's a metaphor for anything, though. And that's a weakness of the film. I feel like it's not really well thought out, and I think it's a little too slight. And I think it takes this very odd topic, people who think they're animals, and doesn't deal with it in any kind of psychologically real or frank fashion. It's not about psychology either. It's about a feeling of being an outsider. And I suppose there is something freeing about that in quirky movies. Films that celebrate being an outsider.
Right.
But it's not strong here. It's pretty weak.
All right. Well, let's review some movies on the critically acclaimed scale. Hi, Luca. Luca, you want to review some movies with us?
Luca's trying to reach up onto the table.
Did you watch any of the movies? He watched Power of the Dog with me. He thought there'd be more animals
in it.
Okay, let's review some movies on the critically acclaimed scale. Our critically acclaimed scale goes from C-, that's the lowest you can get. It's below average, to C, which is average. A little something, you know, mixed bag. Not good, not great, bada bing. And C+, which is above average. C+ is our highest recommendation. We genuinely recommend you see the film, or maybe we think it's the best movie we ever made. Somewhere in the middle. On that note, Whitney, where does Wolf fall on the critically acclaimed scale?
Wolf is a C-. Yeah, this whiffs it. It's not Not well thought out enough.
All right. Flea. The animated documentary Flea is interesting considering how bold the form it's using is, how ultimately slight the movie feels because of its just personal intimacy.
Curious.
But I'm going to give it a mild C+. It's definitely an emotional journey, and I think it's absolutely worth going on. Let's see, Diary of a Wimpy Kid.
A C. It captures certain things about the childhood experience. I appreciate that it is, you know, a little bit brief.
Yeah.
Doesn't need to be epic. And I did like the animation style, where it's very simple stick figure kind of looking CGI figures, and it's an interesting look that you don't see in a lot of movies.
All right. Torn. If you had asked me right after I'd seen the documentary Torn to rate it, I probably would have given it just a C. But it stuck with me, and I think in a nice way. I think it ultimately, its story about coming to terms with how a family has changed over the course of tragic circumstances got under my skin in a nicely insidious way. So it's a C+. Let's see what we got here. The Hand of God.
Hand of God. I'm going to give it a high C. Okay. It didn't knock me out of the park, but I appreciate that. Knock it out of the park. I am a baseball. Knock me out of the park. I don't think it's quite the home run or the slam dunk or whatever sport metaphor you would like, but it does do a lot of things very well. I think the characters are very rich. I think the place is very rich, and I kind of liked being in that space for a while, even though there are details about the film I didn't like.
All right. Benedetta.
That's a C+.
Yeah.
It's wild, kooky, sexy, satiric critique of religious hypocrisy and also, without condemning too much, dealing with a little bit more complex attitudes about how sex and piety can coexist.
Yeah, you would think based on, you know, it's Paul Verhoeven, it's a story about sexuality in a very repressed Catholic environment, that this would be a very anti-church, or at the very least anti-religion kind of film. But I was actually impressed by how nuanced it is and how it really shows how people want to have the cake before they eat it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love this movie's fantastic. Really great performances all around. Really potent story, and yeah, all of the all of its luridness is very, very much
very like, pointed,
very pointed, very targeted, and it just really hits on all levels. And then lastly, The Power of the Dog.
The Power of the Dog, C+. Yeah. This is really one of the best films of the year.
Yeah.
It is about important things, and Jane Campion is such a skilled filmmaker about giving us such an emotionally rich tale through what seems like incidental moments.
Yeah,
that it's really going to grab you.
The fact that this movie feels completely natural, and you don't realize just how much of like an ornately planned chess game it always has been. It's a really stunningly made motion picture. So please go see Power of the Dog. It's a C+. And that is it for Critically Acclaimed. We will be back in a weekish.
Next week.
What's coming up next week? What do we got next week? What's
going
on?
Golly, what don't we have? I know the new I Love Lucy movie is coming out next
week.
It's
Ricardos.
Called Being the Ricardos. It's written and directed by Aaron Sorkin. I've seen that one already. And many other Oscar contenders besides Sean Baker's Red Rocket is coming out next week. I'm going to have to look at my list.
Hold on, we got Red Rocket. We've got Being the Ricardos. We've got West Side Story.
Oh, that's right. West Side Story.
West Side Story is coming up this week. So that's a lot. That is a lot. Okay, so thank you everybody for listening. If you would like to subscribe, if you haven't already, please do. Hit subscribe wherever you find us. We have a Patreon over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. Thank you to all of our patrons, without whom this show would not be possible.
Yes.
So thank you to everybody who has taken the time and has, you know, helped pitch in to keep this show and all of our other shows going. If you join in on our Patreon, we have a lot of exclusive shows that are just for patrons. You can also vote for future episodes of our various programs. But we have shows that are dedicated to every single episode of Star Trek ever made, every single episode of the 1960s Batman. We've got every single film ever nominated for Best Picture. We got to get on that. We have a new episode of that coming up soon. We do commentary tracks, and we also have some cool legacy content. We reviewed a lot of like TV movies.
Oh yeah.
We did every single episode of Firefly. We've done a lot over there. And that is all currently available at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. If you would like to join in the conversation, there's a lot of different ways to do that. You can follow us on Twitter at Critic Acclaim. I am at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
But the best way to do it is actually to email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. And we might read your email on an upcoming episode of our show, We've Got Mail, where we read your letters, answer your questions, respond to your criticisms, and basically yield the floor as much as possible to our listeners, because we couldn't be doing this without you. We want to give you some your time to shine as well. We also have a P.O. box for people who like to send us actual letters, or sometimes people send us things in the mail, which is very, very kind of them. Whitney, what is our P.O. box? Yeah,
right into the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
And I think that's it. I'm on Twitter, at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
And and if you like soap, head on over to our soap store. Me and M. Lapis Da Silva have a soap store. It's called Salt Cat Soap. We're on social media at Salt Cat Soap, all one word. And we have a lot of really cool designs for the holiday season. Very, very cool stuff, actually. I made some peppermint bark soap that looks really, really cool. Michelle made this incredible frozen scene soap where it looks like a Christmas tree and presents have been sort of trapped in a glacier. It looks really neat. So we got a lot of cool stuff over there, good for the holidays. So check that out. And I guess that's that. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And never forget, everyone's a critic.
I want to go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?